everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
So, a lot happening on the blog and podcast in January. It's been a huge month, just like everyone else, giving awards. It's award season, so we've done our best of manga and anime from 2017, all of our favorite picks. Very hard to narrow down, of course.
I mean, we tried not to pick handshakers for everything.
Wow, but was that just last year?
Yes. It's as much as it might seem this eternal, horrible anime that has existed forever, like evil itself, that is not the case.
It's good to remember how time is a construct that I still don't quite understand.
Time is a flat circle.
We also did our fall anime awards for the season. We've done a whole ton of podcasts, too.
If you want to see a whole bunch of Kiss Closed and SWAT reviews, plus, now that Anime Strike is dead, we have a bunch of Anime Strike shows that we've went back and watched since they are now far easier to get without the second paywall. And my manga of the month was In This Corner of the World. You may have seen the movie, but I feel like the manga, the original manga, offers a whole bunch of different things. So they're both worth, I talk about why they're both worth experiencing. Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing.
So it's only been, since we're talking about time as a construct, it's only been 20 years since Cardcaptor Sakura, which is a little frightening, and now it's back. We have a new season Cardcaptor Sakura Clear Card, which is also based on the manga by Clamp, and it's running in a normal magazine. It's not the grim, dark, gritty Cardcaptor Sakura for everyone that's now in their 30s and 40s who originally watched it.
Where, what do you call it? Sakura's become a chain-smoking smack addict.
That's Caro in the dubbed version.
I see. So what you're saying is, there is a new Cardcaptor Sakura, and you're not dreaming.
I might be.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, I feel as though it was very unexpected for this series to come back at all, and then even more unexpected, I think, for it to get an anime. So it's really, we didn't do a SWAT review of it because you really are not introduced to these characters. You know them or you don't. But presumably, you know, little kids who have never experienced the original are reading the manga, and it's in a, you know, a children's magazine, and I assume on in a time slot in which kids would watch it. So I find it very interesting that they really, they take about 5 seconds in the first episode of the anime of Caro's little, you know,
like what happened in the previous series. And then he's like, eh, fudge it, it's not worth it. You probably know this already. All right, too bad.
Yeah, they really don't even try.
He all but goes, you know, this is summary section in Wikipedia. You guys can just go there.
Yeah, so it doesn't feel as though it's particularly, like, inviting. But at the same time, it's not the most complicated concept. Magical girl, she has magical set of cards. they have different powers. Sometimes the story is her battling that card and capturing it. Sometimes it's just a nice little story.
You know, Kate, you say that, but we did have a long discussion with my roommate who just recently, because he had only ever seen Card Captors and like a few selected episodes of the actual Card Captor Sakura. So he wanted to actually watch real Card Captor Sakura before this season.
That's very ambitious. That's 70 episodes.
My roommate has amazing powers of marathoning when he puts his mind to it.
I just reread the manga, a lot less of a time sink.
Do you remember the conversation about the many fractured reincarnations of Clow Reed?
Okay, alright. There's some complicated lore, but I mean the basic concept is pretty easy. I feel it's... In fact, it's... You know, rereading the manga was very rewarding because...
You got more Toya?
Well, always a good thing. And he's really... excellent in this new series. But hold on. Cardcaptor Sakura is very... I think it's just such a special series because it really does both the original concept of the magical girl, which is you have a magical object and maybe you use it to do nice things for people and magical things and there's not a lot of conflict.
Or making yourself and your friends happy.
Yeah, and maybe there's some small personal conflicts, but there's not a world-ending conflict. So Cardcaptor Sakura melds that with sort of the more Sailor Moon scenario of battling and there's a big bad. But it's kind of a trick, right? Because there's not actually a villain in Cardcaptor Sakura. So it's very interesting the way that it balances.
Kate. Okay. I saw Card Captors, the movie, and I know that that witch lady was a bad witch lady who had it out for good guy wizard Clow Reed. And there was nothing else to that story other than bad witch versus good guy wizard and the legacy of that fight in the present.
I can't even remember that movie. What's the real story?
She, like, fell in love with Clow Reed, and Clow Reed was the kind of...
aloof.
Yeah, the, like, how do I human wizard that he is? And so, like, she gets spurned, and, like, she has, like, this, like, long-seated, unrequited love for Clow Reed, and, like, so she can't, like, pass on. Basically, Sakura has to, like, get her to, like, you know, give up. You know, hating Clow Reed for rejecting her. So, yeah, but you know, there was no way that, you know, Card Captors could have it be a love story.
Yeah, I guess they had to parse that into something else. I mean, the TV series definitely has a lot more battling. It still has all of the emotional beats and everything. It does have more battling because it has more cards, for one thing. And... that's an interesting thing with this new series, right? Is so how are they... I think something we're very curious to see is how are they going to balance things that happened in the anime versus things that happened in the manga, because this is adhering very closely to the manga. And so things... There's not major differences or anything, but... there are differences, including the number of cards, so how does that factor in? And we've watched three episodes at this point, and we've had a Mei Ling mention. Don't know if she's actually going to appear, because she was an anime original character, but they mentioned her, so I thought that was interesting. Yeah, it'll just be fascinating to know, is this now going to be a long show? Because it's just such a different time from the 90s when Cardcaptor Sakura came out and the way that they did anime even,
yeah.
You know? Not so many shows nowadays, except for big shonen series, get kind of these extremely long, maybe with filler stories.
Yeah, and the fact that you can go on hiatus for a year or two and come back and keep an audience means that a lot more anime will avoid filler and anime original endings. I mean, it still happens, without a doubt. But that is so much rarer. Yeah, it will be interesting to see. Yeah, if they go back and visit any of those, essentially what were filler cards. Or will they stick closer to the original manga with some Meilin style mentions? That would be very interesting to see. I personally think I would like a little bit of, like, them mentioning the filler stuff, but not too much. Like, if they used it to, like, pad out the story but still went on hiatuses, I think that could be good. If they stuck strictly to the manga with just a little bit of fan service mention, that's probably the safest and way to do it.
And I just wanted to talk a little bit about rereading the manga a little bit more, because I think something that a lot of people who are either kind of got into the series recently because they knew this new series were coming out and they thought, all right, you know what, now I'm going to read Cardcaptor Sakura or whatever so that I can be prepared for this. I saw a lot of people talking about on Twitter about how Rika and the teacher relationship and how that's, like, super messed up. And also, were we, like, more okay with this back in a different period of time than, like, we would be now? And how you read that now, especially for those of us who maybe read it a long time ago and now are reading it again. And you're like, but I thought it was funny because Clamp really shows their bias in Cardcaptor Sakura more than I think any other series, because there are at least three, you could argue four, student-teacher relationships in the series, including Sakura's parents, which are like, I guess we had to have that one, otherwise we wouldn't have a story at all, so thanks for dating your 32-year-old teacher when you're 16.
So yeah, there's Sakura's parents, there's Toya and the shrine maiden teacher, there's Rika and the homeroom teacher, and the, oh right, and then the shrine maiden teacher, Kaho and Errol.
Yeah, and that's the one that's iffy, because technically he's the reincarnation of, or half of the reincarnation of Clow Reed, and so he's not really a child. But he is. I don't know.
I don't know. All I have to say is Kaho there, she has a pattern.
She clearly does. She is a predator.
I mean, she was a super cool character, but if you look at it objectively, she, what do you call it? She took Toya in his, before his prime, and then she's already moving in on Errol.
Yeah, and I actually really liked her, but I'm like, I don't know. So we'll just see. We'll see how many or student-teacher relationships they can cram into this new series, and or we can see if Clamp has moved past that obsession onto something else.
There seems to actually, this is just random that I've noticed, they seem to show a lot more of the teachers. Like, the main people you ever saw in the original was Sakura's homeroom teacher and Kaho. Whereas there are a whole bunch of teachers in this new series, but I don't think any of them.
Oh, that's what you think now, Al. Half of those clear cards are just like weird teacher versions.
Wow. Thanks for the spoiler, Kate.
Sorry, I've read ahead in the manga.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, no, I am very interested because, you know, it's one of those things that, in general, I'm generally fine with it in fiction because it's fiction and it's a prominent fantasy. I think we're pushing the envelope a bit when it's the elementary schoolers and their homeroom teacher. No one was on board with that. I don't know why the editors weren't like, excuse me, please stop.
And it wasn't even like it was in like some pervy like shonen or seinen magazine.
I mean, it's not as if anything happens that we see, thank the Lord, but they're engaged or whatever. So it's a thing. Not that I want to, I don't want to see, I don't want to know. And they seem to have taken Rika out. Actually, not taken her out, like sniped her. But she's in a different class?
No, she's in a different school, I thought.
Okay, so maybe they have purposely removed her from the story because... That's even less cool than it was then.
Like, they seem to imply that they keep in touch with Rika, so she could pop in, but she is not a regular cast member.
Bye! Yeah, so, good call. I think, good call, and then everybody else, again, Sakura's parents, we've just, like, accepted that, and it's over, and we're not thinking about it. Toya has moved on, obviously, and Kaho, okay, we're not thinking about it anymore. The other thing I want to mention about the original manga is that Toya's the best. He's such a great brother! But the thing is that rereading it, I really noticed that they shied away from making him a perfect brother or sort of the fantasy brother that I think, or fantasy sister, you know, I feel like you see a lot of that now, and I think it's just so much more common for them to be really protective and not incesty. I'm not even talking about that, but just really great, you know?
And or like just the most supportive dad / mom in one brother package.
Yeah, and I get that, and it's not that I don't really enjoy that. Like, love a good brother or older sister character, love it. But Toya, I thought they did such a nice job of making him a more rounded as a sibling, because he is looking out for Sakura, he's always going to protect her, but he's also, like, gets annoyed with her, calls her names, calls her basically little monster, because she's always stomping around, and she's a lot younger than him, so I feel like he teases her like a brother would, and I don't feel like I see that a lot from an older sibling. Sometimes you'll see kind of the annoying younger sibling, but...
I feel like... If that happens, it's usually the older sister character who will be the ball buster that actually has your best interest at heart.
Yeah.
But yeah, the older brother is either usually an antagonist or like the perfect older brother. But yeah, you really get that like in between.
Yeah, and I thought that was really nice. And I think we're seeing that still in the new series. He's a little bit older, so he's even more great, doing great things. And of course, I mean, he's so great that even some of the cards fall in love with him, so...
Much like Kate.
I understand. I get it.
But Kate, you didn't talk about the bestest character. The perfect bestest character.
Oh, Tomoyo?
Yes.
Tomoyo, best friend of best friend. I mean... I don't remember which of us, or if we were all discussing this at once, but it was, you know, we're talking about how observant Tomoyo is, that she's just such a good friend to everyone. So other characters, I think, are more focused, but she is just the best friend. She's mostly more focused on Sakura than anyone else, obviously, but she's still such a good friend to all people and all creatures.
Like, your life goal should be, I can't reach it, but I want to be closer to being a Tomoyo.
I mean, she is the embodiment of a fictional character. No one. I don't think anyone even gets 50% Tomoyo in their life.
You're like, I reached 25% Tomoyo. Life goals accomplished.
Wouldn't you agree?
No, Tomoyo's the bestest, awesomest character. But she doesn't feel like a Mary Suey insert character. She's just like a super loving, like, cool character.
Very supportive. And she has her eccentricities.
Yeah, she's not perfect, but what do you call it? She is close as us miserable mortals will ever be.
I really hope and look forward to seeing her bodyguards in this new series, because I always loved when they showed up, because they're all these, like, badass women bodyguards, and they just work for her crazy mom, so...
I do like how her crazy mom's like, fuck that dad.
She accepts him by the end.
Begrudgingly.
Begrudgingly, but she does. I feel as though she always did, really. She just doesn't like to admit it. Yeah, just so many great characters. I think it's been really lovely seeing them in the new series. Everybody has their same voice actor, so, you know, it's like very seamless feeling.
I do remember one of the people we watched it with mentioned that, like, you can tell that Sakura's dad is getting a little long in the tooth because he wasn't a spring chicken when he originally voiced Sakura's dad, and now it's 20 years later. So, A, he's not in the show that much, and B, I mean, he was fine. I didn't feel like, I was like, get this doddering old man off the stage! The only thing I will mention very briefly is the weird, like, cognitive dissonance I have now with Sakura, because her voice actress, like, was very Sakura for me, and then some years passed, and she then voiced Nero Saber in the Fate Extra games, and she is, like, the 180 opposite of Sakura, and then her voice, and then, like, I had to deal with that, like, oh, wait, this is the same voice as Sakura, and it was weird to me, but then now I've been with Sakura, with Nero Saber so long that now Sakura is the weird cognitive dissonance again. And since there's going to be a Fate Extra anime at the end of this month, like, now they're going to be competing in my head because she'll be doing both voices at the same time. So that'll be interesting for me. But, I mean, she's still very good as Sakura. Like, I, like, slipped back into the Hoeys pretty quickly. Plus, I think it helped that, you know, rewatching some of the episodes with my roommate, you know, when you hear enough, you remember who Sakura is.
I want to talk a little bit about the plot of the Clear Card series, because I'm very excited to have it back, and it's still early stages, so I think that it will differentiate itself, but right now, it feels a lot like the second arc of the original story. So you have the first half is the Clo card story, where she gets all the cards. Then we have the Sakura cards story arc with Errol. And now we have the Clear card arc. And it just has a lot of the similar beats here at the beginning, I feel like. There's a mysterious figure who shows up in Sakura's dreams. The cards are acting strangely. In this case, now the cards have all turned clear and she doesn't know why. And, you know, we see Errol, like, talking about, oh, I can't mention anything right now, which is something that happened a bunch in the, he was very mysterious, and you think that he's a villain, and he doesn't seem like the villain in this case or anything like that, but he clearly knows more than he's letting on, and Shaoran has shown back up, now, basically, my theory right now is that Shaoran is the hooded figure. I don't know why, but
I mean, they did mention that there's going to be a transfer student in the next episode, but that character could, I mean, if you're right, then that character could be a red herring or, like,
but that's also what happens. I mean, if they're not a red herring, that is what happens in the Sakura story. So I'm just concerned that it's feeling a little samey.
We had this discussion a little bit before that I'm wondering how much. So the original one is she captures Clow's cards, and they're still Clow's magic. And then the Sakura card arc is she basically has to use the cards and make them Sakura's magic. But in a way, they're just Clow's cards with a Sakura coat of paint. And maybe I think the fly card and two of the other cards slightly change how they work, but they're not radically different. And so, but I feel like, and that whole time, Sakura is still a child. She's still an elementary school girl. And I wonder if the whole point of this arc is her becoming a young adult, because it seems like she's recapturing the cards, but every time they transform, so she doesn't just get the Sakura card version of the Windy, she gets like the Gale card. So I wonder if this is supposed to be more of a metaphor of her becoming a young adult. That she's now no longer just, you know, living in the legacy of her, you know, her adults, basically her parents, her mentors, but becoming her own person. And thereby, the cards are being actually remade into actual Sakura cards, not just Sakura's versions of, you know, it's not just a redux of the previous generation. It is a new generation because Sakura is finally, you know, she's not a fully an adult, but she's now stepping on that road that will eventually lead her there. And that's why the cards have to be reborn again. Maybe signaling that, like, every time Sakura, you know, basically maybe, like, if she went to college, you know, if she had kids, if she, you know, started a career, maybe every time she has a major renaissance of who she is, the cards would be reborn because they're an extension of her. So every time she is reborn, so are the cards. And I'm wondering if also her, like, not that we, you know, see anything, but like almost her escalating romance as she is kind of the spark of why these cards change as well. Now that like Lee has returned, you know, she, you know, obviously is in a romantic mood. So maybe that is, you know, that awakening to a like a junior high school love or something like that.
Sakura is the hooded figure in her dreams. It's the same. I don't know. I think that's a great theory. I think that makes a lot of sense. I just hope that the way that it kind of unfolds is different enough than what we've seen before. But I'm very much enjoying it. It feels right, has the right vibe. Also has such a great ending. The ending song and animation is just so good.
And I was delightful. I was really pleased that in one of the last episodes we saw, it was actually essentially Tomoyo who captured the card.
She can be her own. She doesn't even need magic. She just does it.
But it's a fun series, like you said. It'll be interesting to see where it goes from here. But it's still, it almost makes you forget Tsubasa Reserve Chronicles.
I was going to say, it makes you remember that Clamp can do things. I mean, they could make this really convoluted and complicated.
Like, they'll start throwing in Triple Hexaholic and Tsubasa stuff in this.
Well, like you mentioned before, there was the whole who was reincarnated as who, etc.
And clones.
It was, so.
And people who are children of Sakura and.
No, I was talking about in Cardcaptor Sakura.
Yes, right.
No, I'm not talking. We're never talking about Reservoir Cards. Never, ever. Don't ever mention anything, ever, that's ever happened. Ever.
Not about clones. Transformed clone children.
Nope, no. I was just talking about in regular Cardcaptor Sakura. There's a little bit of, you know, reincarnation of, like, who this is, and etc. So, it wasn't super convoluted or anything. It was a little, like, unnecessarily complicated, but it was fine. But they could just up the ante in here!
How about, Kate, and this is, I see nothing to indicate this, but what if they brought in some Triple Xaholic? Because that wasn't horrible.
No.
Okay, that's fine.
It's not horrible or anything, but it's complicated and, you know, convoluted. Which is their two specialty. So it's nice to see them sort of unraveling that and being a little more straightforward so far.
All right. So if you were with us last month, I watched June Tyson. And because I had watched the penultimate episode, which ended the, you know, the Zodiac War proper. And I was like, all right, look, I really need to get this off my chest. And I want to talk about something this month. So let me talk about it here. And if, you know, the last episode really changes my opinion, I'll come back on next month and tell you how things have changed.
And I would not let you talk about this if it was if somehow you changed your mind.
I will say, though, since then, I've seen a bunch of articles really praising what the series has done. And to all of them, I say, get better tastes. Because, oh my God, as much hate as I had for the series last month, that last episode actually made me hate the series more. Which I have to say...
That's why you're allowed to come back and talk about it. Because that... hate for Nishi Oishin gives me life, okay?
Because I've enjoyed some of Nishi Oishin's stuff, like Bakemonogatari and Katanogatari. I've generally found amusing. And then, like, other stuff that he's done, it's just, like, friggin' Zorigato and... Ugh. Like I mentioned, my main problem with... The Zodiac War is, it seems to, like I said, Neo-Asian's whole thing is to take a common, popular genre and, like, break the rules a bit in when he tells a story. And the problem is, I felt like everything that he did to break the rules just showed why those rules existed. And then he goes and takes the last episode to do two things. One, show how short shrift he made all the characters in the story, and then makes it all pointless. So the already boring story that you knew how it turns out, he then just essentially makes the ending as unsatisfying as if it had all been a dream type ending. Once again, spoilers, because this series sucks, so I'm spoiling it so you don't have to watch it. So, the rat wins, and the guy who runs the Zodiac War is like, you get to make your wish, but first we have to debrief you. And he doesn't want to talk to the guy, and he tries to sneak out of the debriefing, and, like, the Zodiac War organization kills him a bunch of times. So eventually he just concedes and does the debriefing, and you get to learn that, oh no, not, although he has the visual novel power of basically being able to make a save point and go back to a certain point in time and make choices until he doesn't die, he feels every death. So he's actually a tragic character because he remembers all the painful deaths he has.
The, like, Edge of Tomorrow power?
Yeah, he basically has the edge, yes.
So they made it more interesting by having a hive mind alien also appears in the last episode?
No.
Oh.
So they just then, he has to decide his wish. So he thinks back to all the conversations he had with all the characters. And it almost seems like Neo-Ishin spends this time going, you know, there were a bunch of these characters I never fucking gave any, like, depth to. Let me desperately try to, like, give one or two characters like the dog some amount of depth in their conversations here. But he only, like, talks to them for, like, half a minute. So, but, like, you learn that, like, the dog adopted this girl and was actually, like, a nicer guy than he appeared in the actual main story and stuff like that. And apparently, like, the boar just wanted a harem of handsome guys. That was going to be her wish. So a lot of people were like, oh, I'm more on board with the boar. You weren't such a bad lady. You at least had a dream I could admire. And so then he'd like, then he gets all angsty about, like, oh, I could wish for, like, all the people to come back, but some of them were scumbags. But then I guess I could wish for all the good people back, but who am I to judge who's good? And plus, if I brought them back, would they actually be the person that I knew? Or would they just be a clone that had their memories? And I could wish for, like, world peace, but would that actually be good? And I could wish that everybody had wishes, but then bad people would have wishes too. And I could just wish for money, but that would be, like, pointless and just selfish. And he goes through all these wishes and he angsts about it and just, like, anything you wish for has a downside. So should you wish for anything? Teenage angst. And then when the guy's like, you must choose, he finally breaks down and realizes he had nothing but bad memories of the Zodiac War. I almost said Holy Grail War, but the Zodiac War. And he just wishes that he didn't remember his experience in the Zodiac War. And then it jumps to the next day. And the one girl who's nice to him in class, because everybody else in his class is a dick to him. Because he's a dick.
I feel as though they have a good reason to be.
Yeah, no, they do. She's like, you know, he actually looks happy today. And you see him contently sleeping on his desk because he's forgotten everything that happened in the Zodiac War. So, basically, everybody other than him is dead and he has wiped his memory. So, it's like the Zodiac War didn't happen.
What is the point?
That is a good question, Kate. I guess it's supposed to be that, like, Zodiac Wars, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Good God, y'all.
I mean, maybe it's because I didn't experience it, but you experienced it, Al. It sounds...
Once again, I feel like it's New Yishin thumbing his nose at the convention, being like, these wars, these, like, battle royale things are always pointless. So, like, the only good conclusion is if they never happened.
But it did happen. He didn't wish for it to not happen, did he?
Yeah, all those people die, and it's implied that...
So he could have wished better, actually.
And it is implied that because the Zodiac War people are just like these, like, evil Illuminati, they wiped out everybody in that city where...
So he should have wished that the Holy Grail War never happened and never would happen or never existed in the first place.
Well, Kate, one, if you wish that everybody in the city was alive again, some of them would have been bad. And, like, he could have, like, brought back to life the next Hitler and thereby his wish...
What?!
This is the bullshit he goes through when he's like, oh, I could wish all these people back to life, but I don't know what they're going to do. So maybe, like trying to change their fate is like, beyond me. I shouldn't have to make these decisions.
But he should have wished the Holy Grail Illuminati out of existence or whatever.
But then they couldn't do the sequel, which is happening.
No!
Which is going to be...
you can't wait for, right, Al?
Yeah, which is going to be 12 Zodiac Warriors versus 12 Zodiac Warriors, because apparently so Fate Apocrypha decided, and now I'm going to do that.
So I don't get it. If it was all pointless and the whole point of the series, let's just say for sake of argument that that's good or whatever, and he made a statement about how pointless this is, then why is he doing another one?
The secret families that run the world use the Zodiac War to determine...
I don't care about the in-story reason why another one. I'm talking about if Nishio Ishin's statement was, this is a pointless, stupid storyline that should never exist and is garbage storyline, basically. Mm-hmm. And I just proved to you how garbage it is. Mm-hmm. Then why is he doing another book about it?
Kate, that is a brilliant question.
I hate him!
I cannot answer that one. It was so, like, the ending was bad, but to then just nullify all of it, even if that was the point, just made it feel like it was doubly worthless. And just, like you said, Kate, Neo Ishin is bad, and he should feel bad.
I don't know if I ever said that, but good call. Okay, so we were lucky enough to see Mary and the Witch's Flower through special event, but it's also getting a wide release in the U.S. Not sure how wide, so check your indie theaters or whatnot.
Or any place that has Fathom events.
Well, see, that's the thing. This was a Fathom event, but it's getting a regular release. So I also don't know if the regular release will be both subbed and dubbed, or you might only, you know, have a dub in your area. So we saw the subtitled version, and this is the new first feature-length film from the new studio, Ponach I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. We don't pronounce anything properly on this show, so it should be normal to you by now. And it's a bunch of ex-Studio Ghibli staff. When Studio Ghibli decided that they were no longer making feature films, a lot of these, you know, animators, writers, director, all of them still wanted to kind of carry on all the things that they learned and did at Ghibli. So they opened their own studio. The style is very Ghibli. If you didn't know that it was a different studio and you just saw the picture of this, you would immediately think that it was Ghibli. And I'm sure a lot of people who aren't knee-deep in anime knowledge constantly probably just think it's Ghibli. And it essentially is.
I mean, they have a... It is a movie based on a classic English children's book, which is, like, pretty much the Ghibli MO.
With two characters that have the most classic English children's book names, Mary and Peter. And they live in the English countryside, and Mary's parents, shockingly not dead. I have to say, that was a twist. They aren't in it, but they're not dead either. And she finds some magic flowers in the woods. So it's a very, very, very classic setup.
Yeah, like you said, her parents aren't dead, but they've just had to move. And so they're settling in at their jobs. And so they send Mary ahead to live with her aunt and get settled in before the semester starts. And so it's the summertime, and she's there alone with basically her elderly aunt and her, like, maid and, like, a gardener. And so, like, you know, she's a young girl who's a little bit bored in a new area. And, you know, she's like this bundle of energy that doesn't really have nowhere to go as she's exploring around because she's making a little too much of a mess inside the house. She stumbles upon a fantastic adventure.
And she meets the boy around her age in the neighborhood, Peter. And, you know, after she finds this bit of magic in the woods, she visits a magic school, and it kind of gets wilder from there, and it just has a lot of that Ghibli magic, especially I felt in the way it built each scene and each pieces of the world that Mary goes back and forth between, from like this magic school in the sky to the beautiful English countryside and the island at one point. And I thought it was a nice twist that the flower that she finds is what gives her magic. And she shows up at this magic school and she just has this insane amount of power. And they're like, "You're like the chosen one." She's like, "Yes. That's definitely what I am." And I liked that it was a little bit of a little bit of a twist on the classic.
Well, she's hesitant at first, but she kind of feels so worthless and, like, not useful back at home that, like, when everyone's like, "You're super useful and the best," she quickly is like, "Yes, yes, I am."
"I am so the best." And things at the magic school are not quite what they appear. And we get hints of that at the very beginning of the series. And we know that, you know, something is not quite right. But we don't fully kind of understand the ramifications of that. And I liked that, you know, one of the things I was concerned about kind of midway is I felt as though the magic that she had from the flower was sometimes too convenient. There were moments
a little too Deus Machina.
Yeah, it was like, "Oh, well, I happen to have the right thing right at this moment." But then I liked that magic was not the full answer to the entire story. So it was something I was worried about in the middle, but then was much happier with at the end.
I think, in a way, the themes rely on magic being generally a Deus Machina. Thereby, it makes sense that it becomes this, like, super simple answer for a lot of her problems. And then, yeah, so it actually is super impactful for the end of the story and the overall story, which I, yeah, like you said, is a I think it's a clever twist. And like you said, it almost seems to be knowledgeable of the kind of the tropes of the genre and tweak them. See how you do that, Mr. Naomi Sheen?
Actually, now that we're talking about that, though, I've never read the original novel. I'm familiar with the author, but the novel is fairly old. Not old, old, but, you know, I think it's probably from the 70s. So I'd actually be curious to know how much they tweaked it, because they tweak quite a bit when they pull these things. I just wonder, did that one, was it, because it wasn't necessarily a so well-worn path at the time. Mm-hmm. So how much are they playing with it, you know, doing it their own way, giving it the Ghibli twist? And in classic Ghibli fashion, Mary is a very proactive woman, young girl, and her friend Peter gets kidnapped and she's got to go save him. You know, I appreciated that quite a lot. She adds another redheaded magical heroine to the lexicon.
No, definitely. This is neither here nor there, but I was infinitely amused that the name of the flower was Fly by Night. Hmm. And, you know, the gardener, of course, he's like, ah, yes, Fly by Night, named after the hit single by Canadian band Rush.
I was surprised too that was in the movie.
Yeah, he was like, Rush, the greatest Canadian rock band ever. Unless, of course, you're in the camp that believes that the greatest Canadian rock band is Bare Naked Ladies. You're young, you decide that one for yourself, whether you're a Rush kid or a Bare Naked Ladies kid. I'll let you decide. You figure that out on your own.
It was a weird in-movie tangent, but mm-hmm. I think we just had to roll with it.
I thought it was brilliant. Best part of the whole movie.
Another thing that I was really pleased with was kind of the entire setup of the magic, finding the magic flower. I felt like, oh, okay, why did that happen? And beyond, this is what needs to happen because it's the story. But then, because the cat leads her there, and I thought, oh, is this, again, sort of, why is this cat being so
helpful? Cat Ex Machina.
Yeah, again, is it there? And I was like, no, I was wrong. There is a good reason that I was not expecting. I really was not expecting them to even address that piece of the plot, and yet it was there. So I was pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's not out of nowhere. Like, the cat is secretly Salem from Sabrina the Teenage Witch and is actually a wizard who was transformed into a cat for trying to take over the world with magic. So, all right. I think we have to answer a question that a lot of people have on their minds, which is this whole endeavor, and I assume Ponek wants to do more films, is let us carry on the legacy of Studio Ghibli. You know, they're one of the most beloved anime studios. They're like pretty much one of the few anime studios that gets a pass outside, you know, in the U.S., how well do you think that they did in carrying on that legacy?
I think they did a very, very good job. I don't think that this, like, felt revolutionary or the best Studio Ghibli, not Ghibli movie I've ever seen. It's not going to say be my new favorite Ghibli movie, but I thought it went out there, it did a lot of things right. It looked really great and picked up in a really good place. You know, this is the director of When Marnie Was There, which I really liked, and Arrietty, also very good. So I felt like it showed the path.
Yeah, I felt like it felt like a good freshman effort. They're clearly, I mean, I don't think that you can underestimate the power and, like, guidance that Takahata, when he was alive, and Miyazaki had when they were under them. But I feel like this showed that even without those two, you know, these guys have learned something from their years at Studio Ghibli. Hopefully, the best scenario would be that, you know, this does well, and, you know, that they grow in their own way, and maybe even are a little better at becoming like a teaching studio than Ghibli. Because I mean, one of the major, you know, problems and criticisms was that, like, the old men of Ghibli were just not very good at passing on or, like, letting the younger guys have a chance. I mean, the classic example is that Hosoda was originally supposed to direct Howl's Moving Castle, and, like, he conflicted with Miyazaki so much that he just had to leave and leave, you know, leave Ghibli in general. And, you know, so the story goes, that's, like, what the whole story of the 6 One Piece movie is about. That it's supposedly, like... I think we discussed this when we talked about that movie. That, the evil baron of the 6 One Piece movie is essentially Hayao Miyazaki.
Wow.
And apparently that was not uncommon. I mean, you know, many of the best Miyazaki films are because he had such a hands-on approach, but he also had it extremely hands-on, like, you're doing this wrong, I'm gonna do this now approach to so much of his work that, you know, obviously they learned, but I'm, you know, while working at Studio Ghibli, I'm wondering if, like, a little more freedom from those old masters of Ghibli might let them hopefully grow in their own directions. And, you know, they have, like, a solid, you know, like, one of the most solid, you know, base level educations. So obviously, if they hopefully have room to grow, they'll, you know, flower in, you know, unique and interesting ways.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. This is their first movie, so are they going to be bringing on different directors? Are they going to be sticking with a smaller crew of directors, like Ghibli did? Where's Gorō Miyazaki? What's he doing?
Curating the Ghibli Museum.
Oh, really?
I mean, wasn't he doing that for the longest time?
I have no idea. I was just, you know, he can make another Up on Poppy Hill, as far as I'm concerned. Great movie. He can do it. He has
just,
it in him.
Just not another Tales from Earthsea.
He can't make fantasies, okay? Mm-hmm. Big fantasy adventures. Can't do that. He can just do very lovely character portraits.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of need for that, you know? That's fine. I'm really excited about this new studio. I really liked their first work. I think you should definitely see it. Definitely worth it. It's a very charming movie. And I look forward to whatever's next from them.
Yeah, I don't feel like you're going to see this movie in hopes that the next movie will be good, because this is a great movie. I'm just saying, I'm hoping that you see this good movie, and hopefully the next movie will be great.
Yeah, and that it proves to a lot of people, which I think is probably what they needed to do, and now that they've shown that they can, hopefully. I don't know if they had any trouble getting this movie made, or what the whole behind the scenes was for this, but I can imagine that not necessarily, that they needed to prove something here, mm-hmm. So, and I think that they did.
This episode's food for thought.
So the food for thought is, what are some 2018 anime that you're looking forward to?
Listen to our song!
Oh,
what's your answer to the food for thought? Just as a reminder, the food for thought was, what anime are you looking forward to in 2018?
I think I'm over anime. I don't think I'm going to watch any anime in 2018.
Okay, you could just rewatch Devilman Crybaby again and again. The internet tells me that's the greatest anime that was ever made and will make nothing but Go Nagai fans.
Wow, that's dark. It's very dark. Dark future that you've given me there. All right, fine. I'll watch some anime. I'll watch some other anime, I promise. There's so much great stuff coming out. I'm overwhelmed. I think... Since he came up before the break, Mamoru Hosoda has the new film coming out in the fall, I believe. Mirai no Mirai. So, I mean, who's not looking forward to a new Hosoda film?
Mm-hmm. I mentioned it, but I am very curious to see what Studio Shaft is going to do with the Fate Extra anime. Because apparently they're doing like a little bit of their own unique storyline with... the thing, so it won't be like strictly based on the game. So
who's directing?
It's a little always hard to tell with Chef because they tend to throw Shinbo's name on stuff when he's usually like executive director a lot of times. I didn't actually look into.
So there'll be a lot of cuts and mirrors and some overlays of color and pattern on things.
I have liked what they've done with March Comes Like a Lion. I mean, every once in a while, the shaftiness gets pretty strong, but I feel like overall... But then again, the original mangaka has a pretty strong style, so she can sometimes beat back down the the shaftiness. So we'll see how much on the shaft spectrum it goes. I mean, it might be wretched. It is still an anime based on a video game. Even if I love those video games, that is not, you know, that genre has a reputation for a reason.
You've reminded me that I am very excited about the Professor Layton anime.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the movie. This is the daughter, too, which makes me really excited. Although it makes me sort of surprised. Not that I don't want one based on her. I haven't played that game yet, but... totally ready for Lady Detective. I'm on it. I'm just so surprised that they never did... This is supposed to be a long TV series, like 50 episodes or something. So...
Did you see anybody's reaction to that game? I don't remember anybody hating it. Like, this is the death of the Layton series.
I think I did see some people being like, this is the worst one.
Oh, okay.
But I'm sure it's fine. I mean, that's... Honestly, that comment was Jay Rando on the internet, so... what use is that to me, really?
It wasn't like, David Brother said it was the worst Layton game he ever played, or like, someone I actually respect on the internet.
Right. I don't remember who said it. I just feel as though I saw some sort of passing comment about it, but... Still, I'm... Obviously, it's based on a game, so measured expectations. But it seems as though they're setting it up to just be kind of this fun weekly mystery. You know, I'm all for that. And she has a dog.
Mm-hmm. I am glad to see that Nobunaga no Shinobi, aka Ninja Girl and Samurai Master, is coming back. I really liked that series. So when and it had been running for a while. And I was like, could it just keep on running? But then when they cut it off, I was a little like, ah. But I was like, yeah, you know, series come back a lot recently. And it has. So I'm, you know, ready to see the conquest of Japan in silly style again.
I don't know if it's coming out this year. I think that it is. But I'm really excited that they're doing a Cells at Work anime.
Mm-hmm.
It was also, spoilers, it was my pick for best manga of 2017, and I'm so excited because an anime, you know, usually gets a lot of people on board with a series that they haven't given a shot yet, and everybody should be reading Cells at Work. I think it's going to be delightful as an anime.
I think everybody, both of us, can both agree that the new Lupin this year.
Yeah, woo! More Lupin!
Super interesting.
I'm just excited about anything that happens in Paris.
Yeah, apparently the last Lupin did well enough that they're kind of doing it again. That one was set in Italy, so this one, they're like, let's go back to the origin of Lupin the First and have a bunch of French adventures.
Do you think... Oh, I forgot her name.
Rebecca Rossellini?
Wow! Just knew exactly what I was going to say. Do you think she's going to appear? I want her to come back.
Is it the same? Is it like, because I think this group is still, I think it's still the same group. So I feel.
You mean behind the scenes?
Yeah.
It seems to be doing in the style of the new Lupin style.
Because I saw he's the Blue Jacket still.
Yeah.
And it seems, and they've been doing the specials recently. So I think it's the same people. So I'd hope that she comes back. I mean, as much as I love that character, she doesn't have to be like in every episode.
Oh, I don't want her to be a crew member, but I definitely want her to make a grand like appearance in an episode.
Yeah, either like she would be a great like either mid-season, like she pops in, or she would be great if she came back for like the finale, like as somebody who like helps them out with like whatever they have to do for their final mission at the end with all her crazy money and does something. That would I think would be like the best use for her.
What a great character. How rare, I think, for a long, long, long running series to introduce a character in sort of such a late addition and not make her a permanent member, but to make a character that I actually want to see again that much with a group that's already so established. Great job, guys.
And obviously, it's already clearly going to play on the original Arsène Lupin legacy, so it'll be interesting to see how that works in there as well.
Because I'm me, I have to mention the 22nd Detective Conan movie. I don't always mention every movie that comes out. I mean, I love seeing them. But this one is a black organization movie. It's got explosions. And Kogoro is arrested for the crime in this movie. And Conan has to, prove his innocence or whatever. So
who is he going to dart to reveal?
Obviously Sonoko.
I see.
Which is going to be great.
Today's a bunch of bad news, but how is the original author doing? Because I know he was...
No update as far as I haven't seen anything about the hiatus. You know, the hiatus is ongoing, and no news, I guess.
Okay, I was just curious. It just popped into my head that I know the last time we spoke about him, he wasn't doing super great. So I was curious if I'm just always reminded of
the mortality of all authors.
I was just gonna say, the Kanagi lady who, I'm on hiatus, and then when she was finally revealed to see it, that brain thing, and fortunately they were able to, she was able to recover from that and is kind of working again. I think she's a little almost back to speed now, and she was able to end Kanagi, and she's gonna do a new series soon, but and then, like you said, how many mangaka aren't that fortunate that, and then they just passed away at the age of 40.
Yeah, and, I mean, obviously the Detective Conan mangaka is not super young. So, but so far, we wish for his recovery and hope for good things.
And speaking of wishing for good things, I think... our last title that, once again, I think we're both looking forward to. This is not guaranteed to come out this year, but a lot of signs are pointing towards it, which is, apparently, if you missed our mention of it on the APB, it seems people have been putting in a lot of trademarks for JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Part 5.
Woo!
What looks like a anime logo.
Yeah! We need more JoJo's! It's been too long!
And it seemed like in between parts, the like hiatus and like how long it is before the announcement gets longer and longer.
Because part four was 2016.
You know, I'll be once again like part four. I know I said this when part four was greenlit. I'm really curious to see the fan reaction to this one. Because, like, part four, I feel like it's a tonal shift.
But everyone loved part four.
Yeah.
So.
But I feel like once part five is where his art style really changes. It is the one that's, like, famous / infamous for being the Fujiyoshi favorite.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how much the art changes. Because the art has changed a bit over the course of the series, but I think they've tried to keep it more consistent in the realm of the same. So I wonder how much it'll shift and how much they'll try to keep it kind of in line with what they've been doing.
You know, it's more JoJo's. There are definitely some cool characters and some cool parts of this for everybody. And what, I think, I don't know, nor do I on a certain level care about what everybody else thinks. I know pretty much everybody, you know, living around here will be enjoying it probably.
I want more JoJo. I want more of it. I'm open-minded at this point about how they go about it. And really, we all have to support part five so we can get part six.
I feel like there is this certain segment that just wants Jolene.
Yes! Yeah! That segment right here in this room, okay? I don't know anything about part five, so I have no opinion, okay? Mm-hmm. And the only thing I know about part six is that it's just got a bunch of women, so I want that.
I'm still the holdout for part seven, but,
Again, I don't have any problem with part seven. I'm sure part seven is great. I'm good with it. I look forward to part seven.
Just get me to part six and...
Yeah.
You can do what you want after that. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
Okay, bad news first.
Look, Kate, to some people this might be good news, but
you don't know which one I'm going to say.
Go right ahead, but I think I know which one it is.
Anime Strike is gone.
Oh.
Aha! I tricked you.
Oh, all right, because that's not bad news at all, though.
I mean, I guess it's not bad per se. Bad for them, I guess, or something.
I don't feel like this is going to destroy Amazon.
Anime is the thing that brings down Amazon. People have been trying to do it for years. They really should have thought of this first.
Or like, this is like, now Amazon is out of the streaming business.
No, but I don't know. I don't know why I said bad news. It's good news for those of us who didn't want to pay a lot of extra money to watch Anime Strike, which was a dumb thing to do anyway. And they also canceled their Bollywood exclusive service at the same time and just rolled that all into the Amazon Prime streaming. So it wasn't just anime that was not working on this model.
There's still a paywall, but I feel like enough.
Well, you have to pay for streaming.
Yeah, but like I was about to say, I feel like enough people just have Amazon Prime. Like, the number of people in the U.S. who have it is, like, surprisingly large. So I feel like, and it's not like all those Anime Strike titles went away. So I feel like now, if anything, it feels like a lot of those titles are a lot more accessible to everybody. I don't know how more discoverable they are, but I feel like, and they had some really strong titles. I feel like the one that I saw the most praise for was Land of the Lustrous. But Recreators, I feel like, got a lot of like surprisingly good things. Made in Abyss got a lot of praise. In fact, while I was researching one of the other news articles, like, I just saw this thread of people being like, Made in Abyss isn't that good. I don't understand why all these people like it, which is, you know, just... If people have to go out of their way to mention how much they're not into a series, that usually just, oh, so I guess a lot of people do like this series.
That's true. I guess I wondered if it means anything in the greater context. I mean, like you said, these shows aren't going away, which is good. A lot of them will also be streaming on HIDIVE now. And a lot of the Amazon stuff seemed to be in partnership with Sentai. And it was almost as if Sentai, I don't actually know what their plans were, but it felt like they almost abandoned the anime strike thing immediately because they created HIDIVE last year. So anime strike only started a little over a year ago. They basically closed it after 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So even before that, though, HIDIVE was created, which is the Sentai portal streaming site. So it's almost, I don't know. I don't, I'm very, it's very interesting kind of, I guess, how quickly all these things happened and what does it mean in the greater context? I don't know.
I mean, I know I've seen debates back and forth of, you know, people who like the competition, but I feel like the problem is it was rare to find anybody who thought Anime Strike was a good idea. Like, it is a little sad that Amazon, like, I wonder if Amazon is going to try to get any more anime titles for their platform. But is that really the worst thing in the world if they just go to, essentially, Funimation, Crunchyroll, or HIDIVE?
Crunchyroll and Funimation are one entity now, so that's not really competition.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, the competition is better. It should exist. It's almost one of those things that you're not sure how much it can sustain because anime is so niche that it's not just movies or something. So I didn't like the Amazon model. I never paid for it. I was never going to. And I'm not sorry to see anime leave Amazon, probably.
It's not like there's nobody else who's a big player, because, I mean, I think the other one that people are murgurger about, but definitely less than Amazon Strike, is Netflix, because their, like, policies are so weird. Like, they hold certain shows. If they make the show, they just release it all at once, and it's fine, because everybody just pretty much gets it at the same time. But if they license a show that's, like, on Japanese TV, you only get it a minimum a season after it's released, and then that creates, like, this discussion of people who watch it afterwards and people who watch it pirated. They don't talk. There's that divide of fan base. But so many people have Netflix. Is it better discoverability? And, I mean, this only really affects me. But apparently, it seems like they have the rights to, like, that New Fate Extra anime. And it comes out the day that we're recording this. But it comes out on Netflix on the 31st, which is, like, several days later. But they haven't announced where, so is that mean it's streaming? Like, the speculation is it just streaming in the U.S., in Japan, and then it'll come out on other countries later? Or is it one of those things where, since it's on Japanese TV, they'll be streaming it on Netflix everywhere but Japan when it comes out with that few days delay? And, like, I guess we'll discover that on the 31st.
Okay, so to the really actually bad news. Tokyopop has now officially licensed their first three manga. They, you know, returned in, I think it was 2015 when they came back, and they were kind of partnering with people and doing some original comics and whatnot and licensing things, or tie-in kind of stuff. But now they've actually licensed manga.
In the U.S. and in a lot of other countries, they just disappeared. But yes, for most of our listeners who are probably American, or, you know, at least have access to American manga, they are back in that game again, which I guess to some people is yay, but to, like, most of the people I saw, I was like, oh, Tokyopop again.
I'm very curious to see what their sort of strategy is, I guess, because are they thinking that their name holds, like, a lot of nostalgia for people and that's what they're going to be banking on? Because does anybody who read Tokyopop, I mean, it's been a long time at this point, does anybody have Is anybody who still remembers them, one, still reading manga, and two, of those of us who do remember them, most of them are in the community and have lots of bad things to say about them. So it's a very interesting time, I guess, to see them doing this because, you know, they're known for shoddy translation, not paying people well, you know, kind of not...
All the drama and misdealings with their Amerimanga titles.
Yeah, so I guess, is there a whole subsection of the fandom that I don't interact with that is really supportive of them? I guess I don't know. I feel doubtful about it.
And I actually kind of feel sorry for the titles that they got. None of them, I thought there were only two, but of the two that I read about, neither of them seemed like, oh man, I really wanted to see them. But if you were like a fan of those series, but none of those titles seemed like killer, like you know, the next Attack on Titan. I wonder if those titles had been picked up by a company with, you know, a more active company, would they have had a better chance to thrive and maybe find an audience and, you know, maybe get the authors of those titles a little more of an international market? That's why I said I feel a little bad for them. Like, you know, if they'd been picked up by Kodansha, Yen Press, or Viz, maybe they would have, you know, had a better chance to find, you know, an English-speaking audience.
I don't know how I'm going to keep an eye on this because not only am I not interested in these titles, but I definitely just don't feel good about Tokyo Pop anymore. So I guess we'll see if they end up licensing anything else. They could be this very, very tiny publisher, kind of like One Piece Books, or is there anybody else still that's very tiny? That's the one that comes to mind, but I just can't. I'm just trying to imagine a panel at a con where everybody's asking really pointed questions. Anyway. Okay, so I just want to bring this up briefly because I almost find it amusing that Udon Entertainment released an update about the status of their Rose of Versailles English translation where, you know, like, it's just very, I don't feel as though we often get a little status update beyond either it's happening or it's not, or it's canceled, or here it's out and here's a date. It's just a very strange.
I got, from the impression I got, somebody like hunted this information down and then it became a public statement. Because, yeah, they licensed, Udon licensed the Rose of Versailles manga, which was like, whoa, what? Because that, once again, it was considered, it and the anime was considered like unlicensable. And then Right Stuff got the anime, which was hella surprising. And then, like, a while went, and then Udon got the manga, and it was still like, huh, it was still a little bit shocking that, you know, somebody could work out a deal with her. And everybody expected, like, the first book to come out maybe like half a year later, and then nothing.
By the time this allegedly, when this first volume is coming out, it's going to be 3 years since they licensed it. And the thing that I found most interesting about this statement is that there's probably lots of things that are taking a very long time, but one of the things that I thought is so interesting that definitely most other manga companies do not do is that they're waiting to translate the whole thing. So that's not usually how it works. Most of the time, you know, they do it as they go and release a volume here and there. But they basically said that, like, they're 80% of the whole series translated. So they're waiting until they're completely done, which would certainly take a very long time. So I guess that's one of the many holdups. They didn't actually explain what any, like, they just said, yeah, we're doing it, and they did say how far they're going, but they didn't actually explain any of the, there's still rampant speculation about why any of this is happening, so.
The only thing that I know about them is, once again, they're doing the Fate Material books, and they, like, released the first one fairly quickly. And then, like, nothing. And I, for the longest time, just assumed that, like, the first one didn't sell. But then there was, like, a Udon Right Stuff sale. And it was like, oh, here's the second book.
And then I pre-ordered it, but I didn't, like, hear anything about it. The only reason I knew that the second one had a release date, it was, like, up for pre-order. And, like, the third book, I assume I will have to find out the same way. It seems like the only thing that really, like, super communicative and, like, have a very strict schedule is their Street Fighter stuff. That stuff, if you want to know when a Street Fighter thing is coming out, they will tell you up and down. But, like, all their other titles seem a lot more like...
So we'll see. Again, it's supposed to be out, they're saying, you know, like, this year for... Or, I guess... Actually, they're not. The first... I don't know why I said that. The first line is, we do not have a solid release date. So, liar, I am. I was being really hopeful.
Just because when I was looking at the list, it said, Rose of Versailles update. I was recently at Kinokuniya, the Japanese bookstore. I saw those new Utena manga. They're re-releasing in Japan the Utena manga. And it reminded me that there are... With those new manga, the re-release, they are doing new chapters of, I think it's like 3 new chapters of Utena. And it's like just recently, all the, you know, Crunchyroll News and Anime News Network recently mentioned that's like, ah, yes, the third chapter is out. Which is just, it just popped into my head that it's interesting. And Rose of Versailles, same thing, has been getting like new, like little mini side story chapters recently. I just find it interesting that both of those series are getting like new little snippet stories, especially like when it's like those series have been popular enough that like they're getting re-released and the manga card going back and adding a little bit to those stories.
I wonder if we'll get any of those Rose Versailles chapters in this English release. All right, so we mentioned kind of earlier that it's awards season and there's a bunch of, you know, manga stuff going on. So the, I know I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Anglume Award in France, they are giving their special award this year to Hiro Mashima for Fairy Tail.
It seems like he keeps coming up.
Sure. I mean, I don't know.
You clearly want to say something, so just say it.
I don't know. I feel like, okay, I guess. Fairy Tail is not really a great manga that has added a lot to the world or anything, but
like, once again, he is one of those, we've mentioned it, it's that odd phenomenon of manga that we know and know is popular but personally do not know anyone who is a huge fan of.
And I'm sure I said that like every manga needs to be really like important or something, but I guess I don't mean that. It's just that it doesn't, I don't know. Oh, I guess they didn't give it to Fairy Tail. They gave it to him. They weren't like, Fairy Tail, the greatest manga ever made. Here, it deserves a special award, but...
This seems cruel. Is it that, like, it's like when you find out that, like, the Big Bang Theory is, like, the most popular show on American TV?
Ever! Okay? Ever of all time! Didn't you tell him really upset about this?
Well, you are talking about the Big Bang Theory.
Yes.
Yes. You are not that upset that they gave her award.
No.
I just wanted to clarify that. I know what you were talking about. I just want to make sure the listeners know.
No, I'm not that. I'm sort of just like, I guess, about this.
Slightly perplexed, as opposed to you scream at the gods about Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, it doesn't have a list of the other people who've won the award, but I think Rumiko Takahashi has won it. I'm sure Jiro Taniguchi got the first time. That was the first mangaka to get it, or probably, like, Katsuhiro Otomo or somebody. I'm sure they've all, like... won this.
They just gave Jiro the award and then they just misspelled his name again a little so they could give it to him again. What? Those are different guys. We gave the award to him twice. What?
And they are holding a multi-part exhibition of Fairy Tail.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Look, Kate, next. It's not the Tokyo Ghoul guy, so that's something, right?
I mean, can somebody tell? I'm sure I could look this up, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say, well, has Oda won this award? Like, you know, that maybe that would be.
then everything would be like, all right, I guess we got to give it to somebody this year. You can get it.
Okay, so another award comes out every year. In fact, this is the 63rd, so they've been doing a very long time, is the Shogakukan Manga Awards were released, and it's a panel of mangaka. I think the judges change every year, the judging committee. I assume that, like, obviously all the titles are published by Shogakukan and the Shogakukan Awards. I know that sounds obvious, but I just wanted to, you know, point that out, that it is an award for their manga, not...
Or manga.
Yeah, so if you feel as though something is missing or whatever...
You're like, what? Why aren't these Kodansha titles, which are very good, on here? I think you know why.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted to say.
I found it interesting that I was, like, just because it is Shogakukan and people talk about them more, I was able to find out a lot of information about everyone except for the kids one. But I feel like that's, although they have the blurb on the news article that we're looking at here, I feel like kids manga generally gets overlooked because, you know, it is, you know, you go, manga isn't just for kids. Kids manga is actually just for kids. Just seems to be like, I make friends with creatures who live on the ground. It seems like super kid friendly. Were you surprised by any of the...
Most of them I haven't heard of. I've definitely heard of Koi wa Amegare no Yuni. I think that it's got a live action or something. There's a reason I know it. I don't know why. But I think there's like either a live action series or they're making a movie or something about that. That's the, like, 17-year-old high school girl who harbors a crush on, like, the older manager at the family restaurant. Doesn't it just sound like, oh, and of course they've made a live-action series out of this. Like, otherwise, like, I don't know the other titles. Like, I didn't know the shoujo title. Shockingly, I do not know this one that's, like, Zapang or whatever, 5. And,
but, yeah, I was about to say, that dude is, like, super seinen. Like, all of his titles are, like...
I mean, I know who he is, obviously. Yeah. It's just, like, a manga about war and ships.
And politics.
Like, the cover of the manga is just a ship. It's not even a human being.
Yeah, he just makes very, like, right-wing-friendly political thrillers. Thereby, you know, just... There's definitely an audience for it, but it isn't the two people in this room recording right now. I was interested that the Shonen winner was The Promised Neverland, which, once again, I feel like gives me more indications that whenever that series gets an anime, you'll hear about it a lot more around here. Just because I hear about it more and more and more and more in Japan. And, I mean, they just released the first book like in December in the US through Viz, but I still don't really hear people talking about it. But once again, it's one of those things where that's kind of how manga works in the US. Once you have an anime, like the world changes for a manga and how it does here. You know, sometimes it's a little bump, other times it's, you know, a radical difference. I just, more and more, I have a feeling that if that has at least a decent, if not very good anime, you will be hearing a lot more about that series. Since we're talking about that, there was a much more general manga award that recently came out. That's the Taisho Awards, and that doesn't have winners yet, but we at least have the list of the nominees. And The Promised Neverland is one of those titles. It was actually interesting that at the list, as I was looking through them, because we've talked about, in between both of us, a few of the titles. And then a few of the titles are just known titles. Like I said, Made in Abyss is here. And then there are these titles that, like, I couldn't find any information about in English. And were just obviously... I felt like the more non-standard the art style was, the harder it was to find any information about it in English. Like, once again, Promised Neverland in Shonen Jump, very what you would think of as manga art style. Made in the Abyss, when we did the SWAT review, looks very video gamey. To Your Eternity, same lady who does Silent Voice. She still has a very anime manga-y, what you traditionally think of anime manga style. One of the other two that like I hadn't heard of before, like the one about Smile at the Runway, which is all about like fashion. Still, like you could easily see it as an anime and manga, but like the ones that have the more like underground art styles, like nothing. One of them, I could only find information on like Spanish sites.
I think it's kind of a good mix of stuff people know about or that we know about, and then totally brand new stuff. Things like Delicious in Dungeon, which I've read a little bit of. Atelier of Witch Hat, Al very recently talked about and was Manga of the Month. To Your Eternity Made in Abyss, The Promised Neverland. And then there's like, so it's like about half of the list is like known and then the rest of it is unknown. The one that stuck out to me the most was the Beastars. It's presumably from the cover, it's a anthropomorphic society or maybe just dogs? I don't know.
Because I, once again, as I said, I went to Kino and they had a bunch of the volumes like on like a shelf, and I thought it was all dog boys, but the cover we see here has a dog girl on it. So
okay, I just want to say to everyone, to be more clear, when you say dog boy, that sounds like cute Bashonen with dog ears. Okay. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's very misleading.
Yes. I got your clarification, but I mean there might be other animal people. But yeah, they are full furry, full fur all over, very canine features.
And, you know, it's the Beastars, so I'm like, are they superheroes like that, or are they doing something? Because this person is just in sort of a school uniform, or maybe just, yeah, it looks like a school uniform, so I'm just so curious what's happening. And it's pretty rare to see this type of art style in manga, at least mainstream manga. I can't even really think of one. I'm like totally fine with it. I'm just so curious about it. Because what could the story be? I don't know. And it's just a society of animals, which I'm fine with. I mean, Sherlock Hound is, I think, falls into this category. And I love like Black Sad. Fantastic.
It's, you know what it is, Kate? I know what it is now. It's just a huge Zootopia.
Yeah, homage. Right? Like, love Zootopia. So I'm, like, somewhat cool, but also don't want to say I'm cool with this because I don't know what it is. Because, like, obviously we know the internet, it can go many ways. And I wanted to mention the thing that I thought was another interesting thing about this Manga Taisho Award is that it's people who run bookstores are the nominating committee for this. And there's a cap on how many volumes of the manga can be out, which has to be less than 8. So it's supposed to go to something that's new. And they're really trying to highlight new series. So I thought that's a really cool goal for the award. And I was looking back at some of the old winners. Things like A Bride's Story, Silver Spoon, March Comes in Like a Lion, Thurume Rome, Chihaya Furu have all won this award. And some of these things have been nominated in previous years because they still are under like the less than 8 volume. I guess Promised Neverland has been nominated before, as well as Delicious in Dungeon. So again, this is 12 nominees. They won't actually announce the winners until April. I'm most curious about the one about the girl and, like, something with movies.
Yeah, no, that one I actually got a little bit of information. It's, like, this weird... It's supposed to be about a manga about making movies and how, like, it's made. And, like, the framing story seems to be there's this director who looks like a little girl. And she, like, is, like, can only make B-movies. And she, like, finds this girl who just moved to, like, Mollywood or something. Like, basically Hollywood with one letter off. And she's like, I'm going to make this girl into a star in my movie that's, you know, going to be better than a B-movie. But from that description, I'm not sure how much of it is the frame. How much is the focus on the framing story and how much is the focus on how movies are made? That you don't actually have to read the series. But I do feel like I know, like, one or two people who would, like, really like a manga about movies.
Yeah, but if it's also a weird little girl who's not a little... I don't know about that, but...
Once again, I wonder how much is the framing story important and how creeperilla it is. I guess one would have to read the series to find out. Oh, I did find it interesting also that there was one that I couldn't find much information about that looks like some kind of romance series, but from the tags, it also seems to be a lot about like workplace politics and stress was like one of the tags on Baka Manga. So at least it seems to have a little... It's not all about romance. It does also seem to be about office. Once again, it's one of those things where you have to read the manga to see where the, where the focus lies, but I thought that was interesting.
It looked like from the cover that was two women in romance. What is that? Was that your impression from the...
Like, I didn't see it tagged for, same-sex relationship.
Okay.
It didn't not tag it for same-sex relationship. Once again, it was very bare-bones information.
So from the cover, I think it might be about two women, which would be very interesting, because I feel as though so much of the Yuri that we see in the U.S. is like young high school romances. So having it be about like two working women, if that was what it was, and maybe it's a small picture, so I'm maybe inferring incorrectly about that one.
From what you've read, which one would you like? Or do you have a hat?
Oh, that I would like to have win?
Yes.
Well, can I say that I don't want Delicious and Dungeon to win?
That's your only requirement?
That's my request. I guess then my only other option is To Your Eternity, which I'd be completely fine with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has probably a good chance. Actually, I say that without knowing what the actual committee is looking for when they nominate these.
I
know everything.
Or the quality of most of the other titles.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just curious if you had like a horse that you would like more than others. The most important thing is you have the horse you don't like.
No, I say To Your Eternity. Did you know that I'm quoted on the back of the first volume in English? That's right.
So that one has to win, so your name can be quoted far and wide.
That's right. So that my name will live on forever. Somehow that will be the thing that does it.
Historians will look back. Who was this woman who wrote an insightful blurb on the back of this book? Why, her name was Kate Brenner. Brilliant writer.
I'm glad that you at least understand. What about you?
I guess of the titles that I have read, I guess I would go with Altair or Witch Hat. I feel like I really like The Promised Neverland, but I feel like it's a Shonen Jump title. I feel like it's going to get praise and eyeballs just for what it is. But I feel like Altair or Witch Hat, I feel like with a little bit of a bump, it could kind of get into that, like, The Magus's Bride category of like, oh, there's just enough buzz around this that it gets more attention. And I think the setting is very interesting. So I guess if I would pull, I would pull for that one.
Our last bit of news is about the preservation of anime and manga in Japan. So the Diet is introducing this bill when, actually, now they're back, so they would have introduced it into, for a vote. I want to read the name of this committee. The Diet members for manga, anime, and game suprapartisan lawmaker group. I mean, don't you just want to be part of that group? They want to collect original manga materials and anime cells for preservation, which, is cool. A little late to the party because anime cells, not really, like... They don't have those very much anymore. But
are they going to go out and find collectors? And
well, it says that the bill aims to prevent the acquisition of cells and manga material by foreign collectors and minimize any of it leaving the country. So kind of put it, elevate it up to, museum quality or, some, how there's certain, antiquities or, materials that you're not supposed to take out of the country of origin.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it would elevate it to that.
It's just funny how, all the old stories about, how animation studios were like, how do I get rid of this shit?
Burn it. Dump it.
And then they're like, what? People outside the country want to buy this shit? Sure.
Yeah, so it's like, seems a little bit late to the game for this, but better late than never. And they also want to build like a national arts center or add that those acquisitions to that center so that it would like, you know, have exhibits and so it would be open to the public. So it's not just preventing people from collecting anime cells.
It just, it does seem...
They're going to raid that store that's in Nagano Broadway. There's a store that just, it's just full. And they're just going to go there, shut them down, and just take all of it.
I do feel like it is almost the, it is like the eternal cycle of like, a new medium comes out, and the people who make it are like, who would ever want this in 10 years? And then like 30 years down the road, everyone's like, why didn't we save this? Like with old TV shows. Now there are all these people like, why didn't we save all these old TV shows?
Yes. Yeah. It's the same. I mean, it's the same thing. And it's very interesting because it says that facilities like the International Manga Museum and whatnot, it says current facilities are currently constrained by copyright law that prevent the digitization of cells for preservation. So this bill would also create that new center that would be part of the Diet Library and get around the copyright law thing. Anyway, hopefully this happens so mm-hmm. that they can preserve things 20, 35, so, I mean, years and years after they probably should have. But, and then we can all go to this cool exhibit hall and see all of it. All right, so one final, like, announcement here at the very end is that
I finally finished Deep Space Nine.
Yes. I mean, hasn't the speakeasy for 97 episodes been leading up to this moment?
Well, it's true. I just finished Star Trek Deep Space Nine today. I just wanted everybody to know that. I finished my rewatch.
Congratulations.
I did mention this podcast. So there you go, Internet. I finished. Now the actual news.
We are bringing back our rewatch podcast this year, and we will be rewatching Record of Lotus War, the original OVA, not the TV series. And we also, alongside that in the rewatch episodes, we will also be talking about the Seven Seas release of the novel, The Grey Witch, which covers about half of the OVA. I'm very excited. I am glad we can get back to the rewatch. You know, we took a little break. And I have a goal of just watching every 90s show that really, you know, made an impact. Record of Lotus War rewatch podcast. We'll let you know. We'll kind of do a, you know, a zero episode and give you a heads up before we start rewatching if you want to rewatch along with us. And look forward to it. I'm really glad that we're bringing the rewatch back.
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.
Man, Kate, so forgettable.
I said that it had to make an impact, so if you can't remember it, that shows that it doesn't. Saber Marionette J?
Yeah, so obviously we're getting to Saber Marionette J, like, 2 shows after this. Your favorite Saber Marionette J. The show that you always use as your example of, you know what's a shitty 90s character design? Like Saber Marionette J.
Yeah. I have nothing to say because that is exactly the perfect summation of why anyone ever brings up that show or ever should. So, anyway.
and after. It's changing every day.